M6, number 3A.
Yes. So we come to point 5, the one and the many. This is a terrific, big and deep philosophical question which has deep meaning for the ontological understanding of Christian Science. It is a question that has come up again in this century, round about the middle of this century, a question that has been asked 2,500 years ago by the Greeks, and has no more been touched properly because there was no answer to it. And it's only in this century that, through the ways of physics that pushed over the borderline into metaphysics, that this question somehow received an answer. And it is naturally a terrific big question in Christian Science. If we would get the answer of this question right and properly, we would really be over the hump, so to say. What is this question? This question which has foxed the philosophers since the Greek period. There was always that great dilemma, which somehow could never be resolved because it seemed to be a terrific contradiction. On one side, there was a definite feeling that the universe is one, that there is only one, that reality consists of one deep-lying substance, that everything somehow stems from a one, and that that one shows itself forth in this terrific universe of so many things and happenings as an infinitude of phenomena. So that on one side one had a sense there is a one, and on the other side one had a sense of infinite phenomena, the many. How can the concept of a one be reconciled with the concept of the many? This seems to be irreconcilable. The Greeks already could see that they were witnessing a constant and ever constant change of phenomena, an ever greater variety of phenomena, and so they were asking themselves, has every phenomena its own principle? And they somehow could feel that that is not so, but that there must be underlying, therefore, something, a unifying principle. And so they put up the hypothesis that there is a unifying principle, underlying single substance from which all the infinite phenomena would arise. And so they were seeking and seeking to find this underlying unifying substance. And that started off what has been brought further in its achievement in this century, actually only with the research into matter through the atom physicists, to seek, so to say, a basic principle, a basic substance. How? By dividing the phenomena and seeing if we divide and divide always to smaller and smaller particles, would we not find finally something that is the same for all phenomena? Is the universe not built up of the same substance? That's the great question. So that they could feel, if that could be found, if it would be possible to bring back all the phenomena to one single substance, then we would only have to find the laws of relationship, the laws of restructuring this fundamental substance in order to bring forth again the infinite combinations of this fundamental substance as infinite variations. So that actually only the laws of structuring and restructuring would have to be discovered, so that out of the same substance anything could be created and built up. So this problem is fundamental to natural science, but it's also fundamental to Christian science. Because fundamental to Christian science is the sense of oneness, therefore of one principle, of one substance, out of which every experience, out of which everything that we experience is made. Here again we see the two methods that have been applied. The method of the Greeks, which was much more the materialistic method and approach. They felt, starting right back from Democritus, that you start out from matter and begin to divide matter. And you begin to divide and divide and divide and divide more and more and more in order to find out that fundamental substance out of which everything consists. Now, how long can one divide and divide? Well, the last 10 years or 20 years of the advancement in the research of physics has been devoted to that. And to talk about this last 20 years of physics is something that I actually shouldn't do, because only a very specialized physicist in this field could talk about it intelligently, and I can't. I can only somehow indicate the trend which is seen right now. We don't know what the trend will be in another 10 or 20 years. It will be quite interesting to know that. But the trend that has started, and that usually doesn't never leaves, that is then afterwards extrapolated further and further, is that in the measure they try to divide and divide matter, the more they come to the non-matter, whatever that non-matter is. They either come to what they call ideas, like Heisenberg, actually ideas, not in the sense as we use it now, much more in the sense of Plato, of Plato's concept of ideas, namely that material things are but shadow figures of ideas that lay behind it. Whatever now their concept of ideas is, which is not exactly our concept of ideas, but still it is showing that through the analysis of matter they did not find matter, but they found ideas. That's their great surprise. That Heisenberg said, as they were investigating matter, they found ideas. Today they go further and show that they found structures instead of matter. Idea structures. Can you see? They found relationship. They are pushed somewhere into the functional monism, into the sense that everything is a relationship. And you can just see how the concept of hard-boiled matter disappears, how matter substance slowly disappears. I always like to think of the Cheshire Cat. That is a wonderful symbol of analyzing matter in this century. There is a wonderful big cat, and as you begin to analyze that cat, suddenly you see that it has no more a tail, and then suddenly you see that it has no more legs, and then it has no more a body, and then it has only a head left, and then even the head disappears, and all that is left then is a grin. You see? It's a wonderful symbol how suddenly the object becomes just a concept, that matter disappears. Analyzing matter, matter disappears. This is something nobody had expected. Nobody had expected that by analyzing matter, matter would disappear. But apparently, I'm no authority on it. I can only repeat what one reads in the most advanced modern articles on this question, that one feels a whole new world is opening up, which would indicate that actually materialism has come to an end, that now scientifically one can prove that materialism is obsolete, and that idealism, whatever that idealism is taking its place. And if we push that idealism further, I'm quite sure we arrive at the idealism of Mrs. Eddy, at the idealism of divine mind, which is another idealism. Because we define idea only as an image in the divine mind, whereas the physicists still define ideas as concepts of observation, as conceptual ideas. So in this way they arrive somehow again at a oneness that the whole, that the many, they investigate by analysis, dividing. They arrive, so to say, at the fundamental structure as a conceptual, idealistic structure, no more as matter. If we take the method of Mrs. Eddy, she uses another kind of analysis. Actually, it isn't so much an analysis as a deduction. She says, how can I solve the big question of the one and the many? How can they be reconciled? And she starts out and says, from the infinite one in Christian Science comes one principle, now she begins to deduce, and it's infinite ideas. So she begins to see that the one has infinite ideas. She doesn't go the way of the material evolution, she just takes it from the deductive point of view and sees that this infinite one has an infinite idea, and with his infinitude comes spiritual rules and laws. Can you see? She takes in everything. She takes in the spiritual monism. She takes in the functional monism, because she can see that this infinite is a field of laws, of relationships, of definite relationships. Ideas have no quantity, have no material quantity. Therefore, there is an idealistic monism, but also these ideas are not something per se. See, we must not make that mistake of thinking about ideas as parts. Ideas are not parts. They are not building blocks. That if you take these building blocks and put them next to each other and build them up, we get something big. We only use it conceptually that they are the factors. It's perhaps better than parts, that they are the factors of being, but these factors of being have no limited space or time. They are of quite a different nature, these parts, than if we think about the material parts. Material parts are tiny quantities, whereas the parts in Christian Science, ideas, have no quantity, have no limitation, and that brings us then to another great philosophical question which we want to investigate. So, can you see how Christian Science resolves the one and the many? Just by deduction. Whereas the materialistic concept was the method of dividing. So this brings us to a very interesting new point that we have to see through. Point 6, which I may give the title the whole and the part. The whole and the part. It takes up the thought where we were before, with the one and the many. The many, are the many parts, or what are they? In our old thinking, we haven't quite come out of the old Greek thinking. In the old thinking, we would say, yes, the many's are parts of the whole. Can you see that? We say if something is constituted of many things, then each one of the many is a part of the whole. This seems logical, but it isn't at all. It's absolutely illogical in Christian Science. And we have to find a completely different logic, because in Christian Science, our parts are always the whole. To say the answer right now, and I'm going to reason it out, the parts are never a section. So, how can we reason this out? Again, how does the materialistic approach reason it out? The whole and its parts. Yes, the materialistic is always that which has limitation, and therefore it says, all right, I take the whole. Whatever that is, I take the whole. I divide them and divide, and what is divided, I divide it up again until I really find, as we have seen, the last undivisible part, but they have never found it. When they search further, the parts disappeared and became conceptual ideas and relationships. But if they do that and divide limited things further up, they always arrive at infinitesimal parts of the whole. So their manys are always parts of the whole, whatever they are. If they are quantum, if they are electrons, if they are laws, if they are their concept of ideas, there are always infinitesimal parts of the whole. And they can say, all right, all the parts together form the whole. That was the old maxim, that the whole is never bigger than the sum of its parts. But when we come to the idealistic or the spiritual concept of the whole and the parts, as in Christian Science, the reasoning becomes completely different, and therein lies an answer that we really have to find, and which is the key, really, to the whole sense of oneness. Namely, if we see that in the spiritual ideas are basic, are the basic substance, we can see that they are indivisible, that therefore our building blocks in the spiritual are not divisible. You cannot split up an idea into little parts. But we also must see that an idea is how big? That an idea, because it is spiritual, has no limits, that an idea must always be as big as the whole. Or else principle and idea is not one. Therefore, our parts are as big as the whole. And that is something we have to get accustomed to in consciousness. This is the great change. See, we have to educate ourselves out of a 3,000-year-old traditional thinking. Thinking always that the whole is composed of parts. That a lot of parts put together make a whole. In the spiritual realm, we have to drop that whole thinking, that an idea is a part of the whole, that an idea is part of God. They are never a part of God. An idea is always as big as God. Because an idea has no limits, it reflects, as Mrs. Eddy's term, it reflects the whole, and therefore we can never say all ideas together make up God. Each idea is as big as the whole. And that opens up a completely new approach in consciousness. The so-called parts in Christian Science are actually no more parts. They are aspects. They are relationships. They are aspects of the whole. They are not a little slice cut out of the whole cake. But what in ordinary thinking is called parts, we may call aspects. So that because being is indivisible, because we cannot divide spirit, just as in the material way you can divide up a material object, there you can divide. To that extent where you can't see it anymore with your eye, and finally you can't see it anymore with a magnifying glass, and finally you can't hardly trace it anymore. Not so in spirit. The spirit is indivisible. The whole is indivisible. Therefore there can be no question of parts. What is the equivalent in the spiritual realm of the parts is aspects, ideas of the whole, ideas of God. And ideas of God is idea of the whole, because God, huh? It's not, an idea of God is not a part of God. It's always the whole. And this is something which we have to train ourselves into it. And it takes years and years to get away from the old materialistic and analytical sense of the whole and find that, therefore, what is called parts are aspects of the whole. They are variations of the whole. You see? Can you see, in the materialistic concept of the Greek, they thought, if I find the tiny little part as the underlying substance, then every phenomena is a certain combination of these parts, of the parts. Here in being we have that they are variations of the whole, not of the parts. So that what is called the manys, the parts, are actually only a variation or a variety of the whole as a whole. You never leave the whole. This is the big thing. The moment we touch really that new concept that the whole can never be less than the whole, no matter what we do, no matter how we consider the whole, that the whole never becomes less than the whole, then we have touched oneness in being, the one being. But as long as we still have a conceptual sense there is a whole, that is called God, and that therefore that whole can be divided up in different ideas, and each idea is a part of the whole, we have lost our tone, the tone of oneness, tone of wholeness. Therefore, every idea is an aspect of the whole. Yes? And that's the difference between principle and idea. An idea is always the aspect of the whole principle, not of a part of the principle. And that's the point that has to sink in. If that sinks in, then somehow we are over the hump. We really have then that consciousness which opens up everything. Got that? We come to our next question now, point 7. Being is one. So let's think out the oneness of being from what we have been considering up to now. And consider Mrs. Eddy's concept of oneness. She would therefore go out from the fact there is one being. That's the starting point. That there is only one being. That being is, because its spirit is indivisible. Is indivisible. Therefore, that whole method of analyzing and dividing it up into parts does no more enter. Spirit cannot be divided up. Cannot even be divided up in ideas. It's indivisible. So let's keep that whole tone, that pedal note of an indivisible, infinite, one and only being. But naturally, we can't leave it at that, or we just have a mystical sense of being. The mystics are still with us at that point. And in order to see further into reality, we have to see that this being has infinite diversified ideas. Here we part from the mystics. Here we come in that the infinite has many aspects, has many variations of the infinite, but still remaining the infinite.